Tantor Audio, a division of recorded books, presents Etruscans, Beloved of the Gods, by Morgan Llewellyn and Michael Scott. Narrated by Mill Nicholson. These are the realms of our existence. These are the worlds that bind us. Flesh is tied to earth world, spirit to other world, death to netherworld. Between the three, only the ace travel without restriction. Etruscan proverb, 2nd century BC. Prologus. Extracted from Libri Fatal. The hidden will of the gods, as found in the Etrusca Disciplina. A new translation by Llewellyn and Scott. We have always been. We, the ace, existed even before the beginning. But it was humankind who named us gods, assigning us form and attributing omnipotence to us as well. Then they bowed before us, and we were pleased by the taste of worship. When humans learned to fear the gods, we reached the zenith of our power. Although we are what man aspires to become, in many ways we resemble humankind. We are fickle. The ace can love and hate, destroy life and create it anew. We amuse ourselves by elevating our favourites and tormenting those we do not like, and occasionally, just to vary the entertainment, we reverse their positions. Ostensibly, humans are the slaves, and we the masters. Yet in truth, the relationship is far more complex. Some of the ace say we would be better off without humans, because their incessant demands are a nuisance and a distraction. Others, however, point out the ways in which we depend upon humankind, and insist we dare not destroy them. The argument between the two points of view has raged for eons. Humans will always require gods. We give their lives a meaning. Often we are the meaning. Our existence is taken as their command to exist. We provide them with someone to blame, other than themselves. We satisfy their inborn need of ritual. We give them reasons to celebrate. But we, the ace, also need humankind. Without them we have no definition. Human imagination imbues us with form and face, shape and substance. Interaction with the earth world has become an imperative for us, involved as we are in such a symbiotic relationship. Over the millennia, we have grown dangerously dependent. We stimulate awe and resultant faith through demonstrations of power, such as storms and plagues and celestial marvels. We must, because if humankind stops believing in us, the ace may cease to be gods. Man born of dust is incorrigibly cunning. Like the rat, he sniffs out the smallest advantage. He constantly strives to overcome his limitations and enlarge his sphere of influence by manipulating the gods through his priests. Usually we ignore the pious mouthings of the priesthood, which have little to do with our own intentions and desires. On the occasions when the two do coincide, however, and we appear to be answering some human prayer, man invariably claims he has influenced the gods. This makes him more arrogant than ever. Nor is man above trying to create gods, who are more amenable to his wishes than we are. For this purpose, even his dead ancestors are employed. Unfortunately, the same belief with which man shapes us can transform one of his own into a deity of sorts. Such man-made gods have abilities exceeding those of mere mortals, and in addition embody all the vices of humankind. They inevitably hate the ace, whom they see as rivals and superiors. We call them Sioux, the evil ones, demons. 1. Silent, deadly, and immense. They came whispering out of the bright sky with talons extended. By their unnatural size and behaviour, he recognised the great white owls for what they were, minions of the dark goddess. Their golden eyes burned with ferocity. Their silver claws sank into his scalp and the shoulders of his naked body, ripping his flesh. He bit down hard on the inside of his cheek until he tasted blood to keep himself from crying out. If she was watching from the other world, he refused to grant her that satisfaction. At some distance beyond the trees, he detected a faint but unmistakable glow that could only mean one thing. He must be approaching an area of sacred space. He stumbled as the ground beneath his feet turned to a gelatinous morass, sucking him down, then solidified almost instantly to trap his feet and ankles. With the palm of his hand, he struck the earth, spending a valuable portion of his remaining energy to break the surface tension and release himself. As he pulled his legs free, he felt the draft of wings brush his face. He promptly threw himself back down and cradled his head with his arms. The trio of hunters swept in low above him, the susurration of their wings all the more menacing for its softness. At the last instant, he surged to his feet. With flailing fists, he struck one of the birds in the chest, bringing it down in an explosion of feathers. Before it could hit the ground, he snatched up the creature and held it to his face. The distinctive musty odour flooded his mouth and throat as he sank his teeth into the owl's neck. Trying not to gag on the cloud of plumage, he clamped down hard and inhaled deeply. The owl screeched and writhed. He took another, even deeper breath, forcibly drawing into his lungs a thin vapour torn from the very core of his victim. He was ravenous for the creature's hire, the living spirit it contained. As he inhaled its essence, the energy that animated the owl began to replenish his waning strength. But one breath was not enough. He must have more. The pursuit had been so long. He was so weary. Sensing his intent, the owl redoubled its struggles. Its legs extended abnormally until they could reach around his torso and tear the flesh from his back in order to lay bare the spine to seize and crush the vertebrae with its mighty talons. But he did not give it the chance. Opening his jaws, he twisted the bird's head to one side and snapped its neck with his bare hands. Swiftly, he sucked the last of the hire from the dying body, even as the creature shriveled and decomposed in his hands. Then, with a cry of disgust, he flung the liquefying object from him. Drawing on his new strength, he ran on, pushing his way through closely spaced ranks of sentinel trees. He had escaped the other world, tearing through the fabric that separated it from the earth world, only to find the earth itself conspiring against him. Could the dark goddess extend her reach so far? As if in answer, branches twisted into skeletal limbs that clutched at him, holding him back. A coiling root emerged from the soil, catching his foot and sending him crashing to the ground. As he fell, he was already wrapping his arms around his body and beginning to roll. If he gave up now, the forest would claim him as its victim before his pursuers could. At least he would have the small satisfaction of cheating her minions. Lurching to his feet, he risked a glance backward. Thus he stood clearly revealed to his pursuers. a slender, swarthy man, of somewhat less than average height, with a hooked nose and sensual lips. His eyes were almond-shaped, his flesh fine-grained, but that flesh looked old, worn, almost as if it had long ago turned to parchment, and his eyes, rimmed around with scars, were very tired. The remaining owls ghosted toward him on silent wings, banking sharply to clear the trees. Their pale plumage glimmered as they passed through patches of shade. To a casual observer, they might have seemed beautiful, but no normal owl would hunt during the day. Fighting back fear, but not regret, no, never regret, he staggered on. Sacred space lay ahead. Once there, he would be safe from their attack, because no matter what form they took, these creatures were animated by hire. A hire might be the ghost of someone who had died, or the life force waiting to occupy a person as yet unborn. It could belong to an animal, or a tree, or a flower, for no life was possible without spirit. Nor were hire exclusive to the earth world. Quite the contrary. In the other world, there were many spirits who would never manifest themselves in tangible bodies. But all hire had one limitation. Without invitation, or very special powers, they could not enter space consecrated to the gods. No such restriction applied to the Ace, of course. If the goddess who was now his enemy chose, she could come after him herself, even into sacred space. He had no doubt that she was angry enough. Why had she sent the owls instead? He must recover and decide what to do next. He had to find sanctuary, if only for a little while. As he burst from the forest, his thoughts were so firmly fixed on this goal that he reached the river bank before he knew it. The muddy verge was treacherous. At his first step, it slid away beneath his feet and plunged him headfirst into the Tiber. The icy shock drove the breath from his lungs and stole the warmth of higher energy from his body, leaving him weak again. A powerful current battered him, dragging him away from the bank. Small round mouths, lined with vicious teeth, gaped just beneath the surface, as ribbon-like eels fixed on his flesh. Pain seared up his legs. Frantically he fought to keep his balance, while he pulled off the sucking eels. If he went under, he would never resurface. A whisper on the air warned him just in time. Turning from one battle to another, he struck the owl in mid-air and sent it spiralling down to the water. As it fell, the creature made a desperate effort to recapture its long-lost human shape. Swirling, melting, it presented a blurred image of a woman with the talons and snowy plumage of an owl, and panicky golden eyes set in a human face. Embodied in this hybrid form, the hire had neither the advantages of the owl nor the human. With a terrific splash, it fell into the river, the unforgiving waters swallowing its scream. The eels were distracted from their original prey by the floundering of this new victim. Flowing away from him, they attacked the owl thing before it could recover. They circled the dazed form, entwined themselves around its limbs, and dragged the hapless creature beneath the surface, where larger, darker creatures lurked. Splashing wearily out of the river, he dragged himself up the bank on the far side. His breath was coming in sobs. The flesh of his legs was red from the cold, and redder still from the blood pouring from scores of ragged wounds. The owls had torn his body, and the eels had shredded his lower limbs. As he staggered on, drops of blood spattered the soil. Deep in the earth, something shifted. as his blood excited ancient memories. The banks of the sentient rivers throbbed with somnolent life, which normally required great amounts of blood and passion to rouse it to full consciousness. But this blood was different, vibrant with spiritual energy, and fragrant with the scent of the other world. A shudder ran through the ground, like the first tremor of a quake. When he had dragged himself to the top of the rise, he saw sacred space just ahead. He narrowed his eyes to call upon the weary remnants of his other-world sight for a better look. The sanctuary's glow was blurred, its holy radiance not fully developed. Consecration of the templum was not complete then, but that did not matter. He would be safe enough there for as long as he needed. He had only moments left. He could feel the ground beneath his feet moving and shifting, rippling in long, slow waves. The air began to tremble as before a storm. Who knew what ancient madness lurked in the earth in this place? Caution dictated that he advance warily. There were undoubtedly traps in the lush landscape ahead of him. But there was no time for caution. Summoning the last of his energy, he broke into a shambling run toward the templum, while behind him the earth began to rise in a great, curling wave. A few steps, just a few more. He had almost reached safety when the last of the owls struck him. It swooped out of the sky to sink triumphant talons deep into his flesh. His cry of pain was swallowed as he pitched forward and fell headlong to the ground. 2. Beyond the bend of the river, Bessie strolled in the sunshine. She loved being out under the bright blue sky. Let others shelter themselves in houses, in cities. Above all things, she enjoyed unfettered freedom. Suddenly, she detected a change in the atmosphere, an unexpected chill, though the day was warm. A brief bitterness on the wind, overriding the perfume of ripening grapes. Bessie shivered in spite of herself, then laughed off the sensation. She would not let anything spoil her mood on this radiant late summer day. Tossing back hair, the colour of a moonless midnight, the girl closed her eyes. Wide-set eyes, dark and bright as onyx. Her sheer peplos was dyed with saffron, complementing her olive complexion. A crimson scarf was draped across her shoulders. Strings of tiny silver bells were laced around her throat and wrists, making music with her slightest movement. The bells tinkled as she breathed deeply, savouring the sweetness of the air. Without visual distraction, her other senses came to the fore. She measured the weight of the wind on her shoulders, as light as a lover's caress, and turned her face to welcome its breath, warm again. The momentary cold had been just an aberration. Thankfully, the girl abandoned herself to the delights of the season. With a delicate sniff, she identified the smells of summer one by one. Dew-drenched grass, sun-warmed earth, flowers in the meadow, droppings of sheep and scat of fox, the odour of a young bullock grazing not far away, and an old wolf bitch tardily coming into season. Underlying these was the verdant scent of trees at the edge of the forest and the fecund mud of the nearby river. 100 fragrances assailed Bessie's nostrils, each telling their story of life. There was just one smell she did not recognize. A faint but acrid tang still lay like a stain on the air. She curled her lip in distaste. How monstrous that something ugly should mar the otherwise perfect day. She would ignore it, and surely it would go away. Tilting her head, The young woman redirected her concentration to the natural music surrounding her. She could recognize 60 species of bird by their song, differentiating between those that were native to Etruria and those that merely visited the lush meadows on their way to the northern darklands, or south to the realm of Egypt, the fabled Black Land. One by one, Bessie sorted through various sounds, until she found one she could not identify. A distant, laboured gasping, occasionally punctuated with a groan. An injured wild boar, perhaps? But no, this was no animal. Bessie knew all the animal voices. Perhaps she was hearing a member of one of the primitive tribes her people had dispossessed in claiming this land long ago. Her forebears styled themselves the Razan, the Silver People, although others referred to them simply as the Etruscans. In a time recalled only by storytellers, they had moved into the territory between the rivers Magra and Rubicon. Eventually, their control was total in an area bordered by the Arno on the north and the Apennines and Tiber to the east and south, extending as far as Latium. Force of arms and superior intellect made the land theirs. None had been able to stand against them, neither the indigenous inhabitants nor the subhuman beasts who infested the mountain wildernesses. Not all the vanquished had left the land. Those who remained in the high mountains and primeval forests were in the process of creating legends, tales of the Silver People. Opening her eyes, Bessie blinked against the bright sunlight, then shaded her face with both hands and gazed toward the south. The bitter smell and gasping breath both seemed to emanate from the site of the incomplete Spurrey, the Razan city being built beyond the bend of the river. But the place was uninhabited at the moment. Although the ground had been cleared, and the Pitani, the priests, had blessed the boundaries, the final sacrifices had yet to be made. Bessie knew that none of the Razan would break the taboo and enter unhallowed sacred space without being accompanied by a Pertan. Yet someone was there. As she stood, puzzled, the wind changed, carrying to her the unmistakable odour of fresh blood. Drawing her long-bladed knife from its tooled leather sheath, Bessie glided silently forward. Since earliest childhood she had loved to play at hunting, like a boy, to the despair of her mother, who wanted a daughter to be feminine and delicate. Razan women were works of art. But Bessie had no desire to be a work of art. Such a static image bored her. Life was to be lived. She thrilled to the prospect of adventures. Now her calloused bare feet slid through the long grass, testing every step before trusting her weight. One could never be too cautious. A patch of quicksand might be anywhere. Spurrey were sometimes sighted to take advantage of such natural defences. She drew another questing breath. The blood smell was stronger now. Identifiably human, but disgustingly tainted with something foul. Another groan sounded. There was no mistaking the voice of a man in pain. Abandoning caution, the girl started forward, just as a rising wind whipped her hair into her eyes. It might have been an omen. The Razan believed the gods spoke to them in such signs and portents. The girl paused long enough to take a gleaming silver fillet from the leather purse she wore at her waist. She settled the band firmly on her brow to hold her hair in place. Then she began to run. Since none of her people would have ventured on their own into the unfinished Spurrey, she assumed the groaning man must belong to one of the native tribes, or, more dangerously, be a hawk-faced Roman from Latium, an advance scout for an army, hoping to extend Rome's territory. Such raiders had become a constant threat. Once, the Etruscans had feared no one, dominating not only Etruria, but much of Latium. With increasing prosperity, their aggressive impulses had diminished, however. Erazin had become tired of war, tired of the casual butchery, the stink of the dead and the dying. They had taken their martial arts and turned them inward, using them to create rather than destroy, to build rather than pull down. And now the jackals were gathering. Bessie hefted the knife in her hand, her thumb caressing the hilt with its encrusted carnelians. But she did not hesitate. At the back of her mind was some romantic, childish notion of taking an injured Roman warrior prisoner at knife-point and leading him home in triumph. No Razan woman had ever done such a thing before. She sprinted up a hill, then dropped flat at the crest, so she would not be silhouetted against the sky. From this vantage point she could look down upon the spurrey, spread out below, like some child's toy. The area had been cleared, foundations dug, drains installed, streets laid out. Each house, shop, and public building was already allocated a site that would contribute to the symmetry of the whole. Squares and rectangles were pegged with fluttering strips of pale cloth. Stone footings would be placed to support walls of sun-baked brick covered with tinted plaster. Courtyards and roofs would be tiled. Murals would be painted on every available surface. Terracotta piping was stacked to one side, waiting to serve the fountains that would sparkle throughout the city. The choicest site of all was reserved for the great templum at the centre of the spurrey. Plinths would be placed at intervals along the approaching avenue. Statues of the ace would stand there, gazing down with blind eyes upon their people. But before this could happen, the entire area must be consecrated with blood and flesh and smoke. Then a city wall would be raised to protect sacred space, and construction could begin in earnest. The result would be the finest spurrey ever built, even more elegant than Veii, which was celebrated as the most beautiful city in Etruria. And as everyone knew, Etruria was the most beautiful land in the world. Its inhabitants were the special favourites of the ace.
"Great are the gods, and precious their love," Bessie murmured automatically.
She shaded her eyes with one hand, so she could make out details of the scene below. There. In the centre of the site, designated for the templum, lay a huddled body.
"Desecration!"
When Bessie leaped to her feet with a yelp of outrage, she accidentally dropped her dagger. It struck the soft earth point first, and stood there quivering. She was quivering herself with indignation. Injured or not, the man had gone beyond all bounds of decency. The most sacred space of all had been defiled. The priests would not use it now. The lengthy process of selecting another site for the city would have to be undertaken. It might be many seasons before an equally propitious location was determined. To add to Bessie's dismay, she glanced down to discover that her knife was stabbing the earth. With a soft moan, the girl stooped and withdrew the blade. She removed the clinging soil with reverent fingertips, then tenderly pressed the tiny particles back into the ground, as she murmured a prayer to the goddess Ops.
"May the earth spirits forgive my carelessness. I meant them no harm."
Straightening, she drew a deep breath, The blood smell was stronger than ever. The figures lying in
sample complete. Ready to continue?